accession number 12267, reel 4.
Tony Gibson, reel 4. Marta Fuego Rodriguez, reel 4. Tony Gibson, reel 4.
This village was no more than a hamlet. It was called Shirley-to. And there were four of us who went there first. There was a Chinese nurse, Jean Liu. There was an English doctor. There was a Chinese student who was a sort of general purpose chap. He in fact turned out to be Zhou Enlai's nephew. And there was myself. Later, not much later, we got one or two more, including Doug Turner and Al Dorman, a Canadian, and I think it was Al Dorman. Anyhow, I think that was his Christian name, and also another Canadian agriculturalist, Joe something Shaw. And we settled into a mud hut where we erected a parachute which we'd scrounged from an American base in order to stop the bits and pieces falling from the thatch onto us as we slept. And we used to watch the rats pattering across on this. You can see little feet going backwards and forwards on the parachute. And there was a very nice old lady called Mrs. Fan, who was really the sort of matriarch in the village, and she was our hostess. And we had what seemed to be a good rapport with the village. We began with a clinic. We built a clinic out of bottle with a canvas top. And then we expanded it a bit with other things to cope with the people who were hanging about waiting. So we had livestock, and we raised livestock from all over the place. There was a Berkshire boar, there were two Leghorn chickens, there were one or two goats, there was a Holstein bull. And so people by and by began to bring their livestock along to be serviced, these superior breeds. And then Doug Turner began to dig out a patch and plough it up and plant some improved seeds and so on. And we also organised a nativity play in which Mrs. Fan was the landlady saying no room at the inn. And that's something that always catches me. My voice actually changes when I think of that. Because it was genuine. It was a real donkey. And if I remember, I think Doug was Joseph, and a Chinese nurse was Mary. And the whole thing came across. And I, by that time, was going backwards and forwards between that and the city. So I was sort of walking back and forth. And I went back for that in order to operate the star, which is a torch tied to a long willow branch. So there was a quality there, and I think that was very largely the result of one or two people, particularly Doug Turner, who had, they sort of sunk themselves into it. Meanwhile, I was beavering away to get something happening in the city. And so we got hold of this yamen on the high land, and we patched it with mats. We called the Shidza Palace, Shidza mats. And there was a lot of funny remarks about Gibson's Shidza Palace glowing yellow in the sun, you see. And it was, and we were just banging these mats on to put roof on, you see. And then we started a clinic. and we started a milk round. And I spent a long time trying to persuade the Shanghai office and the American office to yield up just one prime mover. Wanted one half horsepower or one horsepower engine. There's a great guy who, again, was a little bit sort of brusque and bluff and a goer, a Canadian missionary, who was very keen on getting self-propelled. Now, I've used this phrase since. And he said, right, the great thing is prime mover, you see, and you can convert all sorts of things. In the village, we hadn't got as far as a CADA. We'd formed a CADA cooperative, got hold of CADA, and Doug had formed a draft animal cooperative, and Jean Liu had got dyeing going. So there were various things that were the nucleus, and then we did our best to transfer that, and we'd also got tiny little school. And we did the same thing in the city. Meanwhile, the river had been gradually diverted. Well, not gradually. It had been summarily diverted as a result of skullduggery by the nationalists, who sent away the engineer in charge, the American engineer, whose name was Todd, and who had got a reputation for diverting rivers all over the Asia, and he was called Todd Almighty. They sent him off to a conference, and meanwhile, they diverted the river. There was the last little bit, and the idea was that it should be diverted when the communists had time to rehabilitate the dikes in communist territory. So the idea was, the nationalists, to convert this positive thing to a destructive thing. So, meanwhile, the river was eroding, and we began with a space outside us that was a good football pitch away from the river, and by the time we'd sort of finished there, it was down to a rather small cricket pitch. It was eroding all the time. The floods were rising. I went out to Kaifeng to negotiate for something or other, and got the word that the floods had suddenly risen. And so I came back with a donkey and a chap and a donkey driver, and we walked back, whatever it was, 40 miles or so from Kaifeng, accompanied at some point by chaps who moved their rifle bolts in a significant way and appeared to be bandits, to whom I presented a visiting card with great ceremony. And much later on, one of them turned up with a bullet wound to our clinic, having been sort of banditti or possibly communist guerrillas. So I got back to the other side of the river, and the river was like, you could understand why it was called the River Dragon, because there was a sort of bore on it, like the scales of a dragon. And I sort of wandered around and eventually found the railway engineers who had been beginning to rebuild the bridge. And they were finally persuaded to give me a lift across, and they put quite a substantial launch going flat out, aiming upstream, and landed a couple of miles downstream. And so then we sort of carried on there and watched their bridge gradually being destroyed, one after the other, one pile after another. But meanwhile, the work was carrying on, and that we got on the way to setting up a hospital in the city. And the little village team was going well. There was a chap called John Brown, who was a Plymouth Brother, who was a very sincere, a lovely person, whom I was a bit scathing about because he was a Plymouth Brother in the early stages, but I learnt my lesson on it. And he was there, and he was a very gentle sort of person, but quite rock solid about what was right and what was not right. And I had a great admiration for him and kept up correspondence with him afterwards until he died. He lost a leg later on in China with a vehicle smash. And there was also the other chaps in this unit. And I remember coming over one time. I thought how frightful it was afterwards. But I came over walked over, and another chap who was, by way of being a little bit sort of, as I saw it, rather narrow in his outlook, was supposed to be in charge of the store, and I thought the store was a total loss. So I spent the whole day, while he was away, reorganising his store for him, without so much as asking him. I mean, that was the sort of person I tended to be. And people put up with it. But, I, you know, every now and then I sort of realised, well, that was really not quite on. So, meanwhile, we were having meetings in Zhengzhou about the future of the unit. And I argued very strongly that the tide being now turning in favour of the Chinese communists, although the Japanese war was over, it was absolutely vital that we should continue there. So I bulldozed everybody into saying that this was so, and to delegating me to go home and convince the London Quakers that that was to be the case. And I got home and came up against a blank wall and couldn't get anything out of this. I kept on saying, you know, here's something where there's a rapport. There already had been this good rapport in Yan'an with the people up there. Here is an opportunity. And at the same time, I also wanted to make some sort of impact about the government's behaviour. Lady Cripps had come out with the Cripps Mission, and she visited us in Jungmu, and an American friend of mine wrote a satirical poem about what was happening, you see, when we did it. the chorus of it was, "Lay on this for Lady Cripps," you see, and the climax was when we actually went to the piggery. And a boar lay on a sow for Lady Cripps. And he had another sort of phrase about ad maiorem gloriam tonii. He was a close friend of mine, but he sort of sent me up on this, quite rightly. Because by that time, we had 70 people in Jungmu, mostly Chinese, but we were doing a lot of things. We were getting UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Rehabilitation Assistance, and it was intended to be a kind of a model that would work as refugees came back anywhere. They would need to pull themselves up by their bootstraps with cooperatives and clinics and so on. Not a top-down thing, but something that was... Well, in fact, it was pretty top-down because we were the top. We were the ones who were organising it. But nevertheless, that was what I thought about. And I'd been very much impressed from what I'd heard about Rui Allen and the Chinese industrial cooperatives. I never got to see him, though I wanted to. And I thought co-ops are the thing. I still do. So, OK, we got some distance, and after about 20 months or so, I went home on leave. I went home earlier than I really probably should have. It should have been 24 months, and I went 4 months early, partly in order to raise hell about people coming, and partly because after 7 years, I was running out of steam. And but I still had a fair amount of steam up on the question of government policy. So Lady Cripps and co. were much impressed, they said, by what was on going on, what we'd laid on for them. So they said, come and see us. So I went to see her and got introductions to various people. One introduction was in respect of a Chinese student who had been working with us in Jungmu called Wong An Min. He's now a retired professor of animal husbandry in Beijing, known as An Min, no longer Wong. And he had been a leader of student resistance to Chiang Kai-shek, one of the key leaders. And it looked to me and to him as though the place was going to be too hot to hold. So one of the things I tried to negotiate and succeeded in negotiating was to get a bursary for him to come over and have an agricultural
course over here, just to give him time. The theory was he'd bide his time and then go back when it was safe to go back. So that happened. The other thing was I wanted to change the government's foreign policy. So I got an introduction to a leader writer for the Times, who asked me to write down what was happening, with particular reference to this skullduggery about the diversion of the Yellow River. And my father said, don't just write notes, write an article. So I did this, and it was published on the leader page, two columns, you see. So father and I went out and bought every copy of this. And I then wrote round to everyone I could find in the Artists and Writers Yearbook, saying, this is the kind of thing I write. Would you like me to write more? And I got quite a good sort of momentum in writing for a lot of journals. I wrote a couple of turnovers for the Manchester Guardian, as it then was, and I wrote for World Review and the 19th century, and then when it became the 20th century. And then I was stopped working for that because the Americans took it over, and I was given a sherry and my congé because I'd been too critical of Americans. I'd said that the Americans had got, in their magic, their military assistance, something or other, in China. They got the equivalent of a division, and that they were actually giving more backing to the nationalists than they had given through the whole war beforehand, the Japanese war, to troop. And I went into all this. So I got a sort of in on writing and by and by on broadcasting. But meanwhile, I was battering away to try and persuade the worthy friends, or the weighty friends was the word, the weighty friends in Friend's House, that they ought to back up a continuation. And I got nowhere. So...
Was it to do with knowing what the friends are and their sort of ethos? Was it to do with sort of being partisan, do you think? Because, you know, in this period of civil war, which it would have been, wouldn't it, at that time, would it have been sort of too strong for them to have taken sides?
Well, you see, we had already got a very successful unit in Yan'an. We were on both sides, and I thought that we had a reasonably good reputation, that we were independent. And certainly Zhou Enlai had always been very supportive, and he was right on until the Cultural Revolution. So I thought that there was, you know, something. And I also thought that the British government were passing up a magnificent opportunity. So I beavered away with everyone I could find, without any effect. I was reading Dennis Healy's autobiography, and he was on the International Secretariat, and he gives about two lines to Chinese policy. I mean, it's a great autobiography, it's a marvellous book, and I respect him greatly, but he was the International Secretariat, and he gets about one sentence in about China in the late 40s and the early... And, you know, there isn't any real sort of involvement. And there was this enormous country going through a tremendous change, quite as tremendous as the current one in the Soviet bloc. And it should have been a gorgeous opportunity. However, didn't happen.
Yes. Do you think, in the light of what you now know about, you know, 1949 and the aftermath, that the Chinese communists would have allowed the FAU to have stayed?
They might not have, because, in fact, they imprisoned one bloke called John Roo, who was in Jungmu for a while, and that was when they moved in. But I was inclined to think, being safe back in the UK, that was the sort of thing you might expect. And I talked with Spencer Cox, who was actually trying to negotiate. He was there, he stayed on longer, and he was then chairman of the unit. And this is the American friend that I mentioned, who had this very salutary view of my approach to Jungmu. And
talked with him when he came over recently, and he was actually trying to get negotiations right. And in fact, it was dicey because the people at the front edge didn't know anything about us, and therefore they were apt to sort of dismiss anybody who was a Uyghuran, a foreigner. But the people back home had this respect. And I think there was a sporting chance that we could have prevailed and had some influence, but at least showing that British people and American people, Canadians and New Zealanders, were appreciative of what the Chinese were trying to do. And I think on the whole they were trying to do good things. I think their approach to village regeneration was a good one. Okay, there were the Dojong, you know, sort of mass trials of landlords, but I haven't seen any evidence that people were killed as a result of that. It's very often that people were deprived of their lands and put on the margin, and they had to rehabilitate themselves. And certainly the landlords were and moneylenders were appalling. And they would have a chap who represented the Communist Party as a cadre who would be based in the village. And that was, again, something that probably was helpful. It was like having a missionary. And if the missionary was good, the effect was good. If the missionary was bad, the effect was bad. And their approach to getting villages self-propelled was, again, I thought, interesting and exciting, the idea of hydroelectric small-scale power. So I was into this very heavily, and I thought that the village regeneration was the way in which to get people building on neighbourhoods and building from neighbourhoods up to something much bigger. But of course, with the whole business of the coal industry, the rebuilding of the railways and the steel industry and so on, before any, you know, you knew what was happening, it became a centralised state concern. And I think that contributed to the overruling of some of the initiatives, but I don't know enough about that to know for sure. So I came back and I was rabbiting on about what was happening in China, and I wrote descriptions of a communist village, because I'd been up to a communist village with relief supplies when the river was diverted. There was one convoy that went off with a safe conduct signed by the provincial governor in Kaifeng, and was then strafed and had to return, strafed by bombers who came from his own airport. Then we had another one on which I went. And this time, although we went to got safe conducts and so forth, we were not strafed. And we got right up to about 300 miles or so into communist territory and saw there we were based in a small village, which is a hospitality village. And while we were waiting to see the Yellow River, Communist Yellow River Commission and the Yellow River Governor, we were taken around to see other villages. And there was one hospital village, and they changed this every few weeks because they had no air cover, and therefore they could be strafed by American planes supplied to the nationalists. So they would move the hospital from village to village. And again, there was this capacity to get things going. Now, we had 40 truckloads. And the night we arrived, those were unloaded. 3 days later, when we started going back, we saw the contents of the trucks being used all the way down the riverbank. So they knew about organising things, and they had one rather drunken telephone line on willow poles as communication. They understood how you could do things, and they managed to raise the dikes of the Yellow River by whatever it was, a metre or a metre and a half on both sides, before the floods came. So they averted the floods. We finally saw the governor
And when a jeep turned up with two nondescript characters, one of whom was smoking a cigarette by the doorway, and the other of whom turned out to be the provincial governor. And he had long chats with a bloke called Farris, who was a fluent Chinese speaker, was a Canadian missionary, a very radical one, and about what could be done. And then we set off again, came back. So I could see, as I thought, that there was something in this getting practical things happening at a level which people can understand and can be involved in. You can't do things by leaving it to somebody else. You have to raise confidence by getting something done which has expressed your own will to do something and, hopefully, your collaboration with other people. You do something together, however small, and that's a basis on which you can do more. But without that, you're left with top-down, heavyweight political manipulation, and there's no real guts to it. If you go back in history to the birth of the trade union movement, the birth of the co-ops, they were Tolpuddle Martyrs and Rochdale Pioneers who started in a small way, and it caught on. And the fact that it caught on was something that occurred because somebody had done something that was within people's reach. And that's always been my feeling. You've got to get on with something that's within people's reach, but you mustn't lose sight of where it's going to lead. You've got to have the detail, the local thing, and you've got to see the context. You've got to see where this can lead. And that's been really the sort of basis of subsequent work that I've been involved with the Neighbourhood Initiatives Foundation and with the Education for Neighbourhood Change PACs.
Yes, I must ask you about that, Tony. But it would be interesting to know how this compared with the Kuomintang. You know, you've spoken a lot about the communists. You know, what was your experience of the Kuomintang?
They sent me a thought control questionnaire, which I was asked to put down my thoughts. And I didn't. I mean, I ignored them. The reputation was inefficiency, corruption. And everybody I knew had this view of the Kuomintang. And coupled with military misbehaviour. So I didn't think much of the Kuomintang. I didn't swallow the communist whole. There was a chap called Jia Zhouyu who joined us as a student in Shirley Tow and started organising sort of anti-foreign attitudes, you know. And I was a bit of a loss in this, you know. And I remember sort of going up for an enormously long walk with him and trying to argue the thing out with him and so forth. And eventually he went. And when he went, I don't think I forced him out, but the Chinese who were there said he is dangerous. And we can't have him here, Chinese members of the unit. So eventually he was asked to go. And when he went to go to the station, he was tailed by the Kuomintang officials, and they went through every item of his possessions to see if they could find anything incriminating. Now, he was a committed communist, and I thought that he was different in a way from people like Wang Anmin, who had been a student leader, who had been sympathetic to communists, quite rightly so, and who nevertheless had this basic notion about freedom and independence of expression, coupled with getting together to do things that were good. Now, when Wang Anmin came over here and had his 2 years, or something less than 2 years, he was posted to Dartington Hall, and I was asked by the British United Aid to China to go and visit him. And he was in a very bad sort of situation, feeling terribly isolated and looked down on, he felt, by the people there, and he was already sort of beginning to feel that he wanted to get back and be shut of all these English. When he got back, we corresponded a bit, and then he sent a letter saying, please don't write any more, because it was dangerous. Or, I mean, the implication was it was dangerous. And it was only 3 years ago or so that we resumed contact. He came over, and I took him to see the... I was going to say the Jungmu scheme, but in fact it was the Lightmore scheme. And he talked about pigs with the chaps on the sot. And I said, well, you know, that's what we were trying to do in Jungmu. There's another go. We had the same thing. So we laughed about that. And then he went back, and now it's dropped. The shutters have dropped down again, so we can't correspond. But he said then, this was before the big shutdown on the students and the Tiananmen Square. But he said, you know, it's going to be worse before it's better.